says it's willing to start talks with the U.S. to determine whether it will take the prisoners. This after the European Parliament urged members to accept them after President Barack Obama said he'd close the base within a year. There are at least 60 prisoners who have no place to go if they're freed because they face abuse, torture, and possibly death if they return to their home countries. In Moscow, Jessica Gallagher, Fox News Radio.
To Europe with love, just in time for Valentine's Day, Israel allowing 25,000 carnations to be shipped from Gaza.
It comes after a request from the Netherlands for the blooms. Gazan farmers produce large flower crops, but they generally don't go anywhere because of Israel's blockade that bans all but a few exports from Gaza. It's not clear if Israel will allow future flower exports from the Strip. Israel sealed in Gaza after Hamas seized all-out control from its Palestinian rivals in 2007. In Jerusalem, Pia Chattopadhyay, Fox News Radio.
A Valentine's Day message from New York City on the internet.
It seems like everybody's got a Facebook page these days, and now New York City's official condom has one. It's the Big Apple's Valentine's Day stimulus package, urging Facebookers to practice safe sex. What with all those nasty computer viruses lurking around? The cyber condoms are free for the taking, courtesy of the city's health department, but paid for by tax dollars. Facebookers can even send virtual e-condoms. But first, we have to be friends.
That's my friend Todd Starnes, and I'm Jane Metzler, Fox News Radio.
You're listening to 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com, the official stations of New Rock City, the place where you can enjoy a wholesome family entertainment experience.
There's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity. We have a high wind warning in effect until about 11 p.m. this evening. We have clouds this morning and the possibility of a few sprinkles and showers, but more importantly, those winds will kick up out of the west. They'll be averaging 30 to 40 miles per hour sustained at times today, with some gusts up to 60 miles per hour possible. That could do some damage across the areas of trees, limbs, and power lines. Temperatures for the day, lower 50s to start. They'll be falling back into the 40s this afternoon. It'll be mostly cloudy, windy tonight, or nighttime lows in the lower 30s. Sunny and windy on Friday, with Friday's highs in the lower 40s. Clear weather at night, mid-20s. And on Saturday, sunshine, giving way to an increase in clouds. Our highs will reach the lower 40s. There's a chance of some snow flurries on Saturday night, nighttime lows back in the 30s. Then back to sunny weather and seasonably cold on Sunday. Sunday's highs in the lower 40s. Mostly sunny near 40 on President's Day Monday. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for Whitney Media, WVOX, WVIP.
The latest forecast from the 1460 WVOX Weather Center, brought to you by Entergy and the Indian Point Energy Center, right for New York.
At Entergy, meeting our region's need for reliable, affordable, and clean electricity is an everyday success story. That's because our Indian Point Energy Center supplies up to 38% of the region's power needs. It also produces some of the least expensive power generated in the region. And most importantly, it does not produce greenhouse gas emissions. That's right, zero greenhouse gases. This plays a key role in helping this area improve its air quality. So it should come as no surprise that a growing number of environmentalists, including Dr. Patrick Moore, the co-founder of Greenpeace, say nuclear power is a vital tool in the fight against global warming. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.safesecurevital.com. Because the more you know, the more you realize that Indian Point's clean, reliable, and affordable energy is a big part of the climate change solution.
1460 WVOX.
Good morning, and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Levensold, your host for this series on the natural world, education, and culture. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, February 12th, 2009, the 54th day of winter. We have gained 2 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 47 minutes since last we met 3 weeks ago. Days will continue to lengthen until the first day of summer, June 21st, which is also Father's Day. Sun rose 6:53 this morning. It will set at 5:26 this evening. We will have 10 hours and 33 minutes of daylight today. The moon rose at 8:12 last night. It set 2 hours ago at 8:09 this morning. We are between full and first quarter. Next full moon will occur on March 11th, just 9 days before the vernal equinox and the first day of spring. We can already talk about spring. Ain't that something? Next high tides in New Rochelle at 1:09 this afternoon. Yonkers in about an hour at 11:12, and Dobbs Ferry at 11:40 a.m. There's our regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives in Iraq. May they live on in all of our hearts. The most recent report of American deaths in Iraq, 4,242, and then 643 more in Afghanistan, which is 4,885 dead in both of those countries. Best estimate of wounded in action in both countries is 33,724. And that is just American casualties. There are other coalition casualties and, of course, many local Iraqis and Afghanis. The casualties are Specialist James M. Dorsey, age 23, from 4th Infantry. He's from Beardstown, Illinois. He died in a non-combat incident. I still am waiting for a call to tell me what that means. In Kamalia, Iraq, on February 8th. I can't imagine how so many people die in non-combat incidents. Specialist Christopher P. Sweet, age 28. He's from Kahului, Hawaii, also a non-combat incident. He died in Kirkuk on February 6th. Specialist Daryl L. Fernandez, age 25, from 4th Infantry. He came from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. I've always thought that was a colorful town name, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. And Specialist Daryl L. Fernandez, 25, was from that town. He was killed in a vehicle accident in Kirkuk on January 31st. 4 helicopter pilots were killed when 2 OH-58D Kiowa Warrior helicopters crashed in Kirkuk on January 26th. They are Chief Warrant Officers all, Matthew G. Kelly, age 22, from Cameron, Missouri. That's something to become a Chief Warrant Officer at such a young age. Must have been a very sharp guy. Joshua M. Tillery, age 31, Beaverton, Oregon. Benjamin H. Todd, 29, of Colville, Washington. And Philip E. Windorsky, Jr., age 35, of Bovie, Minnesota. 2 soldiers killed by roadside bombs, both in Baghdad. Staff Sergeant Roberto Andrade, Jr., age 26. He's from Chicago. He died on January 18th. And Private First Class Ricky L. Turner, age 20, of Athens, Alabama, died on January 16th. Also by a roadside bomb. 7 of these 9 American servicemen were alive on the date of our last broadcast 3 weeks ago. May they live forever in our hearts, and may this feature come to an end in the very near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Well, it's time for the Culture Quarter, my review of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to differ from them, because everyone, even Joan, has the right to be wrong. Saw a movie called The Class. Francois Bégodeau, he wrote a book based on his actual experience as a teacher in a French inner city school. And he also plays the teacher. He wrote the book, plays the teacher. So he's a teacher, not an actor, although one might say that teachers must be actors. The book is entitled Entre les Murs, which translates to Between the Walls and somehow interprets to The Class, as in the classroom. I guess I can understand that. The walls somehow comprise a cage or a box or some other such entrapping enclosure. Those of us who are familiar with the inner sancta of the classroom will get the imagery. Those of us who have taught and fought in inner city schools will also understand the feelings and pitfalls of the setting. For me, the film was a waking up of feelings I had left behind because they were too uncomfortable upon which to dwell. Been there, done that, though not as skillfully, I must admit, as Monsieur Bégodeau. He is a good teacher. He handles his students with openness and honesty and falls easily into the pitfall of using politically incorrect language. He called a couple of girls skanks, or obliquely, but he did use the word, in his honest way, probably realizing that the kids were going to rat him out, as of course they did. School kids look for ways to catch teachers doing something which the kids do, but are forbidden to role models. When a teacher gets rattled, he or she either has self-control or does or says something which constitutes a gotcha, and they will get you. The film is in French with subtitles. It's well done, probably provides the uninitiated an interesting glimpse into the interplay among students and between students and teachers and school administrations. For my part, I left the theater feeling pained. I was unwittingly thrust back into an environment I had hoped to have left behind forever. Dateline, Washington, D.C., January 28, 2009. America's infrastructure gets an overall grade of D. That's D as in David, and needs $2.2 trillion. That's a trillion with a T in repairs and upgrades over the next 5 years. This is according to a new report by the nation's professional engineers. Decades of underfunding and inattention have endangered the nation's infrastructure. This is the American Society of Civil Engineers speaking. They're referring to bridges, rail lines, roads, aviation, water supply, waste, parks, levees, and electrical transmission. All of that is infrastructure, and all of it, it needs to be addressed within 5 years, according to this group, and needs $2.2 trillion worth of work. That's a lot of bucks. President Obama is directly addressing these projects in his economic plan. There is no reason to oppose him and these projects, yet there are those partisans who will always find a reason and some rationale to criticize, no matter how far-fetched. And this goes for people on the left as well as on the right. It seems more on the right, but that may be my bias that I notice it more. Certainly politicians do that. These are people with no ideas of their own. These are people who, if they had been given the responsibility for such immense challenges themselves, would collapse in a rush of hot air, and I use the word rush advisedly, and blow away like a balloon with the end cut off. Meanwhile, you have a president who is accepting the responsibility and accepting that he makes mistakes and standing up, looking the American people in the eye, and it's just so refreshing, I can't begin to tell you. He deserves to have every opportunity to work and do the best he can. If somehow it doesn't work out the way we anticipate, at least we know he is going to give it a really good try, and I believe he will succeed. So if you are wondering whether to second guess every little dollar that's being spent in this major package that's about to be passed or that's about to be signed, well, you know, when George Bush first took over, I said, okay, let's see what this man can do. I gave him a break. He turned out to be a disaster, but I had to see that. I didn't assume it, and I didn't attack him from the beginning. And I just, well, if that's a good example, then follow it. Give Obama the same courtesy. My first guest today is Louisa Wilcox. She's program staff in the Land and Forests Division of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Louisa's specialties are grizzly bears and wolves. Speaking to us from somewhere in the wilds of Montana, welcome Louisa Wilcox.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Where exactly in Montana are you?
I'm 50 miles north of Yellowstone Park near Livingston and right at the edge of the woods where I actually heard a wolf howl right from the house a couple nights ago.
One? Just a single wolf?
Yeah, just a single wolf.
Is that common?
Yeah, they pass through here quite a bit.
Is it common for you if you just hear one, or do you generally hear more than one?
Either way, you can do both.
Huh,
this was just one solo wolf.
So you're 50 miles from Yellowstone. That must be terrific. I guess you go there pretty much every day, or you...
Very often.
Yeah,
it's an absolute treasure, an incredible natural resource that everyone should have the opportunity to see.
I'm embarrassed to admit I have never been there, even though I have been. Now you know what? I'm going to show my ignorance even further. Exactly what state is it in? I always think Colorado. Am I right?
Most of the park, Yellowstone Park, is in Wyoming,
uh-huh.
And a sliver of it's in Montana. It's right at the corner of Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, where they come together.
So it's not even in Colorado even a little bit?
No.
So I'm totally wrong. So it's mostly in Montana?
Mostly in Wyoming.
I'm sorry. Mostly Wyoming. Okay, I consider myself educated now. Thank you very much. How's your weather out there today?
It's a gorgeous morning with the sun shining over the Gallatin Range across the river.
And here it is, it's hardly winter, it's in easily in the 40s, maybe closer to 50, I'm not sure. We got a lot of nice breeze going on here. It's quite nice for the middle of February, for sure. Tell us, Louisa, what the NRDC, that's the Natural Resources Defense Council, what is the NRDC mission, and what is your personal part of that?
Well, NRDC is trying to protect the pieces of the planet that we still have and restore and make sure that the Earth is still safe for our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. We work a lot on pollution and global warming issues. I work on wildlife and wildlands issues in the West. My role is the Northern Rockies ecosystems, and our top keystone animals whose health indicates the health of the whole turn out to be wolves and grizzlies. And so I work a lot on those species, but because by protecting them, you've protected the last remaining intact ecosystems we have in the lower 48 states.
Now, what does it take to have an intact ecosystem? It's not just throwing a whole bunch of different animals in an area and hoping they survive, right? Why don't you describe an ecosystem for our audience?
An ecosystem is a self-sustaining unit with all the pieces that are necessary to keep itself going in a natural function. And here in the Northern Rockies, we have three ecosystems that have all the species that were here when the Lewis and Clark expedition came across the West. And that is an incredible opportunity to learn about what was the balance of ecosystems. And in the case of wolves, where we had to bring them back, we've relearned the importance of our top predators on the landscape and how they serve to maintain the health of the ecosystem by balancing the prey, elk and deer species that are in this region.
So an ecosystem then is something that, untouched by man or any other disruptive force, will just naturally evolve into a self-sustaining area. Is that correct?
Well, this is not a landscape that's untouched by man, but the hand of man has not been so heavy as to basically make it unravel or significantly change. But it's more or less functioning as it has been for thousands of years.
So a natural ecosystem, let's say man had never set foot there.
Yeah.
A natural ecosystem would be with top predators all the way down the line, and it would everyone would survive in their own way.
Right.
And then, of course, when man steps on it, he throws all that off. And now what the NRDC and what you personally are doing is trying to restore that balance, correct?
Yes, and trying to make sure that the progress we've made toward restoring that balance is not reversed. And over the last 8 years, we've been fighting a serious defensive action as the Bush administration attempted to reverse the progress, allowing the killing of hundreds and hundreds of wolves, and prematurely removing protections for grizzly bears. So we've been fighting defense. Hopefully now we have the political will to do what's right by these species and achieve the reachable goal of long-term recovery.
And how do you expect the Obama administration to differ from the Bush administration?
Well, in their first days in office, the Obama administration took an important first step to signal that they were going in a significantly different direction by freezing a midnight Bush rule that would have once again prematurely remove protections for wolves in the Northern Rockies that would allow the slaughter of hundreds and hundreds of wolves. So the Obama administration said they want to take a look at it. They've frozen that rule. It is not now in place, and they're reviewing it. And the science is very clear that this is an undefensible plan. We're going to be back in the courts if this rule moves forward, and we are hopeful that the Obama administration will take a close look and revise both the wolf and the bear plans to basically reflect the best science and the enormous public support there is for these species and get them to recovery.
And yet you say that the local residents, the ranchers and people who live there, really would rather not have grizzlies and wolves. Is that so?
Many of the local community is very divided. We have a rapidly changing human population. This is an incredibly wonderful place to live, and a lot of people are moving here who share the values, understand the importance of wildlife on the landscape. But there is a minority of really serious anti-wolf, anti-grizzly bear people who are well-armed. And we saw that in action and the problems of this local hostile minority after wolves were delisted last April for 110 days, in a period of 110 days until we stopped the slaughter in court, 110 wolves were killed, one wolf a day, in cold blood sort of incidents where people were gunning wolves down on feed grounds for elk as they were preying on their natural prey. So there's a minority of well-armed people that are really the problem here.
Now, you said there were, I think, 1,500 wolves. Do I have that right?
That's correct. About 1,500 wolves in the three-state region of Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming.
And when you first started your program, there were only 40? Or there were none and you introduced 40?
Well, the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, in 1995 and 1996 reintroduced wolves from Canada to Yellowstone, where they had been extirpated by roughly the 1940s.
Extirpated means killed, right?
Wiped out, killed, shot by federal agents and bounty hunters and all the rest. And they also reintroduced wolves to central Idaho, an area called the Selway Salmon Ecosystem. And after reintroducing wolves for 2 years, roughly 50 individuals, the wolf population expanded and rebounded. There's an enormous prey base. Elk and deer are plentiful here. In the case of Yellowstone, wolves also have buffalo to prey on. And we now have 1,500 wolves in the three populations: Glacier, Yellowstone, and Central Idaho.
And now, you know, some people will ask, who needs wolves? Who needs bears? It's all about humans. The Bible gives us dominion over all of the other species. Are we entitled to just do that? Of course, entitlement is the wrong word, but what value is there to us to have wolves and bears running around in the forest? Why not just make it all nice paths so we could walk and look at the trees and watch the little birdies?
Right. There are several answers to that, I think. First, we have a moral obligation to save endangered species where they have nowhere else to go. And in the case of wolves and bears, they've been reduced to 1% of their former numbers when Europeans set foot on this continent. And they are relegated to the last island postage stamps, if you will, of wild country in places like Yellowstone around some of our great national parks. We have a moral obligation to get these species to recovery where they don't have anywhere else to go because there's so many of us and so much asphalt and development and malls. Secondly, in the case of Yellowstone, it's our nation's oldest park. And in order to save its wildlife, its grizzly bears and wolves, these animals don't read maps. They need habitat outside the boundaries of the park, and we need to utilize the best science to basically protect these animals in the landscapes that they need to survive.
Okay, and now look, psychologically,
yeah.
and biologically,
yeah.
Dogs are wolves. If a German Shepherd's running around in the forest and meets a wolf, they can have babies. It's the same species, really.
Yes, we lose track of the fact that Chihuahuas and Great Danes are all, you know,
that's
descended
right.
from wolves.
If a Chihuahua could find a way to mount a Great Dane, they would have little babies.
Yeah.
Or that could happen. So,
yeah.
Why are people so anti-wolf when they love dogs? What is that?
Yeah, we are really of two comes to wolves. We look to our dogs for loyalty and unconditional love, but when it comes to their wild ancestors, we have to kill them. And I think this reflects a very interesting and complicated battle that we have with our frontier history. Wolves, you know, the part of us that thinks that wolves need to die for civilization to succeed, that's part of our Western frontier mentality. I think we're battling the myth of Little Red Riding Hood. There's this really sort of uncanny fear, which is not rational. Wolves do not kill people, have never killed people in the lower 48 states that we know of, and really are pose no threat to people, pose more of a threat to their prey, elk and deer. But the Little Red Riding Hood myth just doesn't go away. Mm. And there is also, I think, here a part of ourselves that cherishes the wild, that wants to have wildness in our lives, and then the other side, the darker side, which wants to conquer and crush anything that's unknown and uncontrollable, and that is the wild wolf.
And didn't we, in fact, do that with Indians? Those who we could not assimilate, who we could not tame, we slaughtered. And
yes.
I guess the same with wolves. The ones we could tame became dogs, and the ones we couldn't become our enemies. Is something like that?
Yes, I think it's something like that. And I think we're dealing with sort of the political hangover effect of, the hangover of traditional values in the West, and we're in a battle, if you will, over these natural resources. Whether we are going to look in the rearview mirror and how we've treated these animals in the past, mm-hmm. or whether we're going to look forward and see the rightful place that the top predators have on the landscape and the ecological function that they serve to keep these landscapes whole, and move forward and find a place for them to live. And I have to say that one of the things that I do in my work is work with ranchers and people who want to come halfway with these animals. The West is changing. We are not the West we were in terms of absolutely having to kill everything. There is a minority of those values left, but people with those values left. But there are a lot of people who want to find a way of coexisting. And that's what we are really trying to do in our work. One of the things we're trying to focus on more and more in our work is finding those ways that we can coexist with wolves and grizzlies more happily, more equitably on the landscape. And there's many things that we can learn from our history with living with these species.
We are speaking with Louisa Wilcox of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Just in the minute we have left, Louisa, we have... tell us about the grizzlies. Grizzlies, the way they help to fertilize the land around rivers when they hunt salmon. Can you kind of encapsulate that for about a minute?
Yeah, people. There's a lot of very interesting research about grizzly bears that show that its ecological value is much more than we previously thought. And what they've found in the Pacific Northwest with grizzly bears on salmon streams, that bears are actually serving to fertilize the forest by virtue of dragging salmon off the stream banks and into the forest where they eat them at their leisure, and then leave parts of the salmon and poop. And there are high zones of higher nitrogen that are healthy for the forest that come out about as a result of the fishing by grizzly bears and salmon.
Well,
so it's a very interesting relationship.
Very interesting, Louise. And I thank you so much for coming on. We have to go to our break, but thank you so much for being on. And I hope people have a new appreciation for the wildlife, especially out there in the West. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt. Bye.
Okay, you are listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening in Saskatchewan, Prince Edward Island, or Niagara Falls, Canada, in Hohokus, New Jersey, or anywhere in Kazakhstan, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. I am Bob Lebensold. This is Environmentally Sound. Bob Marone is behind the glass. And and we will be right back.
This is the authentic voice of the people.
It's a community station.
AM 1460 WVOX.
Coming up, Fox News, right here on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. This is WVOX in New Rochelle. Bob Lebensold will be right back.
Fox News Radio, I'm Melanie Lyons. Encouraging retail numbers out this morning.
U.S. retail sales jumped 1% in January, reversing 6 months of declines. This is the biggest increase in 14 months.
Fox News business correspondent Brenda Butner. New jobless claims out today, too. They were down from a week ago, but still near a 26-year high. Numbers on Wall Street. Not so good. The Dow down more than 150 points in early trading. Investors not feeling all that confident despite Congress edging closer to finalizing the president's economic stimulus bill.
Many Americans are going to feel the impact in their pocketbooks very quickly because a big part of the bill as it's coming through Congress is a $230 billion tax cut for middle-class families. And those will show up very quickly.
That's President Obama's economic advisor Christine Romer on Fox Business Network. Most Republicans still oppose the bill, saying it's too long on spending, too short on tax cuts. Fox News, we report, you decide.
A better weather forecast for today. We have a high wind warning in effect until 11 p.m. this evening. It looks like mostly cloudy weather, might be a sprinkle or two this morning, becoming partly sunny, very windy. Early highs in the lower 50s, falling back through the 40s this afternoon. West winds at 30 to 40 miles per hour. They'll be gusting up to 60. For tonight, mostly cloudy and windy. Your nighttime lows in the lower 30s. Sunny, windy weather on Friday, with Friday's highs in the lower 40s. Friday night looks clear with the nighttime lows in the mid-20s. The outlook for Saturday, a mostly sunny morning. Then clouding over in the afternoon or highs in the lower 40s. Chance of some flurries at night, clearing on Sunday. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for Whitney Media, WVOX, WVIP.
1460 WVOX.
We are back. Before I introduce my next guest, I would like to tell you about my friends at The Learning Shop in Harrison, New York. You can reach them at 914-835-1070. It's a full-service tutoring company. They provide homebound services. They're in at least 20 Westchester County school districts, so nobody who isn't really good is going to get that many contracts with public education. They're in Bronxville, Rye, New Rochelle, Chappaqua, Edgemont, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They also provide
private tutoring in all academic areas and for any number of standardized tests, including GEDs and SATs. And if there's anything else you need, ask them and they will create a program just for you. They've been running an after-school resource room program for, my copy says 7 years, and I wrote this a couple of years ago, so it's probably 9 years. They've had numerous successes with college-bound students as well as remedial instruction. The after-school resource room program runs 5 days a week from 3:30 to 5:30, and they're just great guys. Education is great. Hospitality is great. It's just a fun thing to go up there. Always professional, and yet just the atmosphere is so conducive to education. That's the Learning Shop, Harrison, New York, area code 914-835-1070. Give them a call if you need tutoring or if you'd like to know more, and you will not be disappointed, I promise you. Okay, my next guest is Rin Berry. He's historical advisor to the North American Vegetarian Society. Mr. Berry has written at least 5 books, plus the brand new 2009 Vegan Guide to New York City, in which he lists and reviews every single vegan restaurant in the 5 boroughs. Welcome, Rin Berry.
Pleasure to be here, Bob. Thanks for
inviting me. How you doing, Rin? No, I'm looking forward to this because you're such an interesting fellow, and because we have some differences of opinion, which will come out. You, of course, are much more educated. I'm just flying by the seat of my pants, but we'll see how that plays.
Okay.
Tell me, do you actually have every single vegan restaurant in the 5 boroughs in this book?
Yes, vegan and vegetarian.
Distinction.
You know, boasts more than 100, because we have well over 100, making New York the city with the greatest wealth of vegetarian and vegan restaurants in the world.
Well, wouldn't some of the those restaurants?
Well, surprisingly enough, they it's not a country for restaurants. People entertain at home, and even in the capitals like Mumbai and Chennai and Delhi, they don't have that many restaurants. It's not like New York.
They're not prosperous enough, probably, to.
They're getting there, they have a tradition of home cooking, home entertainment, which extends back for thousands of years, really.
Tell us, Rin, tell my audience what the difference is between vegetarianism and veganism.
Well, vegans are eschew all animal products. That means externally and internally, they don't consume anything of animal origin, which includes honey, milk, and all dairy products, and they don't wear any clothing that is derived from animal.
No leather shoes, no leather belts?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Nothing.
And even honey. Now, what is that about honey? It doesn't hurt the bees to take their honey.
Well, actually it does, because the beekeeper usually has to use smoke to asphyxiate the bees, so quite a number of bees are killed in the process. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then of course they're depriving the next generation of sustenance, because what is a sort of a capricious delight for humans is really food and food and water to the bees. And
of course there's maple syrup, which is
Then there's so
magnificent. And then there's the agave
plethora of sweeteners on the market that I think are superior to honey.
Tell me, where are you located?
I live in Brooklyn, actually, opposite the museum, Brooklyn Museum.
Opposite the Brooklyn Museum on Eastern Parkway.
On Eastern Parkway, yeah.
And how's the weather in Brooklyn today? Is it like us?
Well, we're having the same weather you are.
Overcast, cool, and breezy?
Buffeted by high winds and overcast, but still very mild for this time of year.
Yes, it is. Now, very interesting, in one of your books, now I said you have 5 books. You may have more than that.
Yeah, 5 books on vegetarianism and allied topics.
I have.
And then one, as you said, one vegan guide, which is now in its 15th year.
I have 4 of your books on the table in front of me. One is The New Vegetarians. I understand you also have a book, The Vegetarians.
Yeah, originally. Uh-huh.
And then you have Food for the Gods, which is vegetarianism and the world's religions, and in that you talk about how each religion handles food.
Yeah, each religion, even the Western religions, have a vegetarian component.
And then you have a book called Famous Vegetarians. That's quite interesting. Some people we would never imagine, like the wrestler Killer Kowalski.
That's right.
And Leonardo da Vinci. We'll get into that in a minute. And, of course, a very controversial and interesting book called Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover, to play on that myth. So those are your credentials. Now, before we get into some of your book work, you make a very interesting point that meat-eating animals smell foul, including humans. So compared to a vegetarian, like if you and I were walking down the street, people would probably want to walk closer to you than to me because I am not a vegan or a vegetarian. But you also balance it. You say that's why the deodorant industry does so well. And I think that's really, really... in the same way as insecticide use leads to allergies and antihistamine use. So they kind of create the chemical industry creates allergies and odors, and then they sell you something to cure it. What do you have to say about all that?
Well, that's very true. I mean, certainly, Asian vegetarians like the Buddhists and Hindus, and they're very sensitized to the body odor of meat eaters, actually, and they've sort of shunned the company of Western meat eaters because they find it quite offensive.
Well, would you say you smell better than me, Ren?
Depending on your preference, I guess if you're a meat eater, then you might prefer the body odor of a fellow carnivore.
I just had to throw that in. Yeah. Everything is subjective, but I do know what you mean, of course.
Right.
Let's go back to the Pythagoreans. Now, of course, you are a historian. In fact, your degree is in ancient history.
I have an MA in classical archaeology and ancient studies.
I find that very interesting. So there were the Pythagoreans. Now, I always thought of Pythagoras as being A squared plus B squared equals C squared in a right triangle, and that's a very astute observation. Mm-hmm. But he was also, besides being a mathematician, a philosopher.
That's right.
He created the first university. He was in dialectics. Mm-hmm. And he is credited with creating the word philosophy, is he not?
That's right. He is supposed to have coined the term, which means...
So what about the vegetarianism with Pythagoras and his followers, Socrates and Plato as well?
That's right. That was a condition of membership in the Pythagorean order. One had to take a vegetarian vow. And the top students were required to be very rigorous in their pursuit of the diet.
And it's interesting because there'd be no way to cover that up. You would smell like you ate meat.
Yeah, that's true. But, very little meat was eaten in antiquity. You know, it was really a luxury food in those days, because we didn't have the assembly line processes of slaughtering animals that we have today. We industrialized slaughter of animals. It was.
Now, here's another interesting thing that you taught me. I mean, we all know that February 12th, it was Abraham Lincoln's birthday, but what I did not know, first of all, he would be 200 years old today. This is Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday.
That's right.
Second of all, he was born on the very same day, just hours apart, from Charles Darwin.
Yeah. And as I was saying, they're both great emancipators.
Yeah. You say the great emancipators. Now, we think of Abraham Lincoln as being the emancipator because of ending slavery.
Yeah.
But what did
Darwin do? Yeah.
Darwin do?
Well, you know, he's devised the theory of evolution. He is credited with having... as George Bernard Shaw said, made the whole world kin, animals and humans, you know, because he demonstrated that we're descended from a common ancestor, and that we're descended from apes and primates, and that we're animals as well as the four-legged animals that we prefer to eat, you know, we as Westerners.
And, of course, if you go further back, we are all descended from bacteria, right?
Yeah, so, you know, there's no divide. There should be no divide between humans and animals. We're all one species.
Now, all the religious Jews and Christians and Muslims have just turned the radio off.
Right. So, I mean, this is considered to be the first great modern insult to humans administered by Darwin.
And now...
Instead of being a little lower than the angels, I mean, We're nothing but degenerated apes.
I look at myself in the shower, and there's no difference between me and an ape, except, of course, for my pretty face, but the rest of me is...
Yeah, right. We're just hairless apes.
Oh, well, the naked ape.
Desmond Morris said naked apes.
Right, Desmond Morris's classic book. Now, something else happened around Darwin's discovery. First of all, it was heresy, naturally, to suggest that God did not make everything exactly the way we see it, mm-hmm. and to not only make that observation, but to demonstrate its truth. It took him many years. In fact, today is also, this year at least, the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species.
Right.
But other things occurred around that whole thing on his ship, the Beagle. Would you fill us in on some of that? We have about a little over a minute before our break.
Well, the initial voyage. I mean, it's sort of Darwin's own voyage of discovery. That's when he gathered evidence to support his theory of evolution. And, you know, it was a round-the-world voyage. And the captain of the ship was an Orthodox Christian, and he and Darwin.
This is the 1 minute news service chat.
Sorry about that, Ren.
They would have furious debates aboard the ship. He being defending the Christian viewpoint that humans were a little lower than the angels and that they're made in God's image, and Darwin taking the view that we were, even at that time, that we were, closer to the primates than to the angels.
And I'll ask you, when we come back from our break, I'm going to ask you what happened to the captain of the Beagle. Okay, yeah. You are listening to AM 1460 WVOX in New Rochelle, New York, or you are listening, if you're listening, in Truman, Arkansas, Central Falls, Rhode Island, St. Matthews, South Carolina. You have logged on to www.wvox.com, and you are listening live, and we will be right back with Rin Berry.
This is the authentic voice of the people.
It's a community station.
AM 1460, WVOX.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lillian Wu. On Wall Street, the stock market weighed down by labor market worries.
Workers applying for first-time unemployment benefits slipped last week. Still, though, near a 26-year high. The number applying for more than a week is at the highest number since record-keeping began more than four decades ago.
Fox's Brenda Butner. Meanwhile, the House gearing up for a vote tomorrow on the compromise stimulus package.
On top of complaints about its cost and makeup, many Republicans are criticizing it, particularly a billion-dollar plan to study which medical procedures are effective.
Fox Radio's Mike Mackowitz. And a massive search underway for a missing 5-year-old girl in Florida, where a joint task force is scouring for Haley Cummings by land, sea, and air.
No longer any reason to believe that the child simply wandered outside, so we are treating this absolutely like an abduction.
John Merchant with the Putnam County Sheriff's Office, Haley last seen Monday night in her father's mobile home. Fox News, we report, you decide.
This is John Fix III from Cornell's True Value Hardware. For years, you've heard me talk about our family-owned hardware store in Eastchester and how we love helping our neighbors with all their home improvement needs. I've told you about our great service and selection and the wonderful associates who work at our store. And now I want to tell you about True Value Rewards, an exciting program that benefits you, our loyal customer. True Value Rewards is a free program that allows you to earn points and discounts on all your purchases. True Value Rewards members get 1 point for every dollar they spend at our store, and each time you accumulate 250 points, we'll mail you a certificate for $10. In addition, each month, selected products at Cornell's are specially priced exclusively for you, our True Value Rewards customer. And did I tell you that the program is free? Even better, when you sign up, you'll receive double points on your first purchase. For more information and to sign up, please stop by. The Cornell's Hardware Store is in Eastchester, between Scarsdale and Bronxville, on Route 22. Cornell's True Value Hardware, serving Westchester homeowners since 1909.
1460 WVOX.
OX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you are listening in Marysville or Canberra, Australia, in Auckland, New Zealand, or anywhere on the island of Tasmania, all down under places, you have logged on to www.wvox.com and you are listening live. We are talking with Rin Berry, who is the historical advisor to the North American
the Vegetarian Society. Do I have that right, Vern?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. I got that without even looking at my note. Okay. What happened to the captain of the Beagle being Darwin's ship?
Yeah, he was conducting the survey of Australia and South America, and Darwin gathered evidence for his theory of evolution, and they had these endless and rather heated debates about the validity of Darwin's theories. And the captain, when Darwin published his theory of evolution, some 30 or 40 years later, the captain promptly committed suicide because he felt greatly insulted by the theory itself. He felt it dealt a death blow to Christianity and the Bible, and he felt personally responsible for having escorted Darwin on all these on this voyage of discovery, which provided him with the underpinnings for his theory of evolution. So
he felt a part of it because he was
because he was the captain, and he was Darwin's conduit to South, to his discoveries.
I wonder if Adolf Hitler's chambermaid committed suicide because she was part of that. She made him comfortable.
Okay. Well,
that's not much of a segue, but let's go to your book here. It's called Hitler, Neither Vegetarian Nor Animal Lover. Now, the myth, and many people still believe it, is that Hitler was, in fact, a vegetarian and an animal lover. And you debunk that in this book very interestingly. Would you like to sum that up?
Yeah, I mean, the most historians, including the most eminent biographer of Hitler, take the view that he was a vegetarian, you know, because they themselves are not vegetarian. They have a very elastic view of what constitutes a vegetarian. They think if you eat meat just a few times a week that you can still be a vegetarian.
I can't see that logic.
No, well, I mean, in actual, Hitler was what they call a flexitarian. You know, he did consume lots of predominantly vegetables, but for medical reasons, his diet, his doctors put him on a vegetarian, semi-vegetarian regimen to cure his flatulence and other.
I would think that vegetables are more flatulent than anything, no?
Yeah, but he had a chronic case of it, you know, and also that, you know, he was sort of a catalog of medical horrors. You know, when he died, they had done a complete physical on him, and you know, he had hardening of the arteries. He had.
You mean before he died? Didn't he burn up?
Yeah, he burned up, and I don't think they've been able to recover the remains. But you know, he didn't have the robust physique of a vegetarian. You know, vegetarians are usually in good health, but he was. He would have been killed by one of those chronic diseases that he was suffering from if it hadn't been for his suicide.
So he was more of a vegetarian than the average person for health reasons, not for ethical reasons.
Yeah, I mean, he did. Yeah.
He had to do it because his doctor said. Now, there are a couple of instances where he actually was responsible for slaughtering animals. What about the Russian
horses? In order to deny the horse, I think there are about 10,000 horses from falling into the hands of the Russians. Yeah, he gave the order to have them all slaughtered.
That was 10,000 horses.
Yeah, because, you know, it was a cavalry.
And what about the German shepherds that the SS was trained?
Yeah, that was part of the
what was that?
Training for the SS in order to test their loyalty to the Führer. They were required to break the necks of the dogs that they had trained with for months. You know,
did they raise them from pups?
Yeah, and they were, you know, German shepherds, but they had to.
And then they had to kill them with their bare hands.
Them, yeah.
And this was part of that training. And then Hitler also injected his own dog, Blondie, with the same poison that...
Yeah, with the cyanide.
Cyanide. Now that, of course, we've discussed that. It could be that he just didn't want the dog to fall into anyone else's possession. And he also wanted to see exactly what death was in store for him, I believe.
Yeah, he wanted to test the efficacy of the poison and make sure it was...
He was going to really
a good
die.
Batch, you know. but as I said, he could have smuggled the dog out and given it to a trusted citizen or something.
I suppose so. There are two things that I would like to discuss and make sure we get in before we come to the end.
Yeah.
We still have some time. First of all, fundamentalists believe that the Earth is just thousands of years old, that God created this whole thing in, I don't know, 6,000 years ago. You are an ancient historian. How far back is ancient history in your estimation or in your knowledge?
Well, I mean, how far back does...
What is ancient history?
Recorded history or...
Well...
How old is the planet?
You're the expert. You tell me.
Well, the planet is, you know, hundreds of billions of years old. I mean, there's no justification for the theory that it was created in 7,000 years. I mean, that's been...
What about recorded history? How far
thoroughly
back
refuted. Well, I mean, that goes back as far as writing is, you know, the instruments of writing, which are about 800 B.C., some of the earliest.
800 B.C., so
the earliest written text.
3,000.
Before that, there was cuneiform, you know, and among the Sumerians.
And cave painting and all that?
Well, that isn't really writing. I mean, that's not, those are...
But it is evidence that there were humans.
Humans, yeah. Humans as we know them, you know, for the modern humans go back maybe 200,000 years. I
mean, okay, so... So when people say God created this exactly the way it is, pretty much 6,000 years ago, you are a historian. You've studied various things. You're a scholarly person. What do you say to people like that? I mean, I've had people tell me that to my face, that that's exactly the way it is. And I also know that 14 billion years ago, life began and the human species alone, just Homo sapiens, without not even humanoids, but humans are 50 to 100,000 years old. What do you say to people when they say that to you?
Well, I mean, the argument falls to the ground. I mean, they can't be supported. I mean, it doesn't withstand our scrutiny. I mean, you know, they can't seriously maintain that, you know.
But they do.
Well, they, you know, if they're fundamentalists, of course, they're, you know, they risk being... ridiculed.
Yeah, I don't know. I call them ignorant, but I can't call them that to their face unless they're smaller than me, really, because they get pretty angry about that. Okay.
Well, that's why the captain of the Beagle committed suicide. Completely shattered his worldview.
The controversial thing I'd like to get to before we run out of time, we still have about 4 minutes. Our nearest relatives, the chimpanzees, do eat meat. It's documented.
Well, they do, but I mean, it's an aberration.
You say that it's an aberration. And my belief, and again, I'm flying from the seat of my pants, and you have much more knowledge, but my understanding of that is that they don't catch a lot of meat because it's hard to catch. They're chasing monkeys through the trees. It's basically monkeys, and they can't catch them.
Then why do humans eat meat? I mean, you know, humans could never have evolved as a hunting species if game are so elusive and so difficult to catch.
Yeah, well, I can't answer that. What about teeth? Now, carnivorous animals, cats, the big cats, the lions and the tigers, I mean, it's I don't know anyone except you who has ever said to me that that they are not natural carnivores. But they have, their teeth canine teeth, right?
They're considered to be
biting
teeth. Those of a carnivore, I mean, they're biting apparatus.
And we have some of each. We have grinders for vegetables, and we have incisors for cutting, and we have canines for chopping things up. It could easily be said that we are omnivorous.
Well, I mean, we're capable of eating anything. I mean,
right.
But, the question is, should we? And, you know, the medical evidence now, has determined that we are, by eating animal flesh, we're straying from our innate frugivorism. You know, we're really classified by the great taxonomists like Linnaeus and Cuvier as frugivores, you know, as our nearest primate relatives. Well, the bonobos and the chimpanzees are frugivorous, you know, so that should really be our diet. And when we stray from that diet, which we're eminently capable of doing, well, then we risk contracting these degenerative diseases like cancer and thrombosis, heart disease.
Well, isn't a lot of that because of the way food is processed rather than food? I mean, if you went out there and you just caught an antelope or a cow or a buffalo that had not been fed artificially and you tore them apart and you ate them raw, would that be the same
problem? Well, the trouble is we can't really catch them and tear them apart. We don't have we're not equipped with
what I'm trying to say is,
and,
is it the meat Or is it the processing, the chemicals that are fed to these animals?
Well, you know, as we really shouldn't be eating meat. I mean, it's not on our, shouldn't be on our menu at all, because we're frugivorous, or, you know, we should be eating fruits and vegetables.
Okay, so the difference between an ethical vegan, which you are, and a health vegan, is that you you're a vegan because you just don't believe that animals should be taken advantage like of that.
I don't believe that we should be preying on animals and torturing them for our own edification. But because, you know, we're not designed to eat them in the first place, and you know, it's extremely cruel to do so.
And you've been a vegan for many years.
Since I've been a vegetarian since I was a teenager, and I've been a vegan since the early 80s.
And are you quite healthy?
Yeah. In fact, I
you seem
run
to be.
Every day.
You seem to be when I met you, and might I say, you also smelled pretty good.
Well, thank you. Yeah, but when I was younger, before I turned vegetarian, I had asthma, acute asthma, and everything. But, that all was all alleviated when I eliminated animal products from my diet.
Was that recommended by doctors, or you just?
No,
decided?
I did it because when I realized that animals suffer. Mm-hmm. To yield their flesh, they suffer when we take their flesh.
Yeah. Okay, Rin, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions. I wanted to ask you about Jesus's recipes and other famous men. That'll have to wait for another day, though, Rin. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you for the interview.
Okay.
Pleasure.
I would like to thank Louisa Wilcox and Rin Berry for their participation in our program today. Not such unrelated guests. Louisa, the activist, protects animals through legislation and activism, and Rin, the vegan scholar, protects them by not eating them or their products and by writing books to spread the word. Our thought for the week: the basic difference between an ordinary person and an extraordinary one is that the first takes everything either as a blessing or a curse, and the second approaches everything as a challenge. Stay tuned to WVOX, your quintessential community radio station, the flagship of Whitney Radio. Next up, quintessential newspaper publisher Howard Sterman with the Hometown Hour. Thank you very much for listening.
From New York's Golden Apple, this is the flagship station of Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX New Rochelle, and worldwide at WVOX.com.